Hey everybody, Stephen here from The Truth About Dyslexia. In today's episode, I'm talking with Martin Bloomfield. This is an actual interview. This is the first one of the year. Now, I've spoken to Martin over the years in different formats. Really brilliant guy over in the United Kingdom. He's been working around dyslexia for ages. He's dyslexic himself and is doing some fantastic work across the world, Europe, beyond, everywhere else. So we wanted to have a bit of a chat about what's going on for him in his life. Now, the topic of this episode is around burnout and work. We touch on a bunch of other topics, but one of the key things that came up for both of us at the end of last year was just how burnt out we were becoming. And some of the things we did to solve that, some of the things that we did to improve our lives. We talked through all that. It's a really interesting episode that goes from tangent to tangent and is just scattered with gold. So hopefully you really enjoy this episode. I've done some work to try and get the audio pretty good, but it's not perfect, so do bear with it. And have an epic rest of your day. I'll get into the interview now. So welcome to the podcast, guys. I've probably done an intro before this, but I usually kind of do two intros for interviews because I forget that I've already done an intro in the interview. But I'm catching up with the amazing Martin Bloomfield, who I caught up with, I want to say 2 years ago now, 18 months ago.
Getting on for that, isn't it? Yeah, somewhere between 18 months and 2 years. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure it was middle of COVID. It feels like a blink ago, but it also feels like an age ago. And
COVID did something. It took away my sense of time. And so I look back before COVID and there was that, was it a year or a year and a half of lockdown, 2 years of lockdown? And that period took away my sense of time. So whenever we look back to things I did in lockdown, I have no idea what time it was.
It just feels like a loop, right? Because everything, it was just changing. It was kind of like what was changing on the screen was changing, but everything else stayed the same. And it was like, we're already bad enough at time, right? And the minute you add in that, it's not going to help. Awesome. So today, guys, for the listeners, what we've decided to talk about, we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. We're going to go off on a million different dyslexic tangents. You know, Martin, we'll talk a bit about his history. He's brilliant. And we're going to talk a little bit about work and life balance because it's something we get asked a lot about burnout for dyslexics. You know, we're very prone to it, how to deal with it, how to accept parts of it, should I say. And then kind of things around, you know, purpose and connection. Like we're just going to have really talk around those topics as we do. So Martin, maybe give me an update on where you're at around work and life over the last year because so much has changed.
I'm getting my stuff back together again. So by the end of last year, I was working on a lot of different projects, some of which I was working contracted for a particular company. And some of those projects felt very alienating. They felt like they weren't profitable to me. And when I say profitable, I mean that in the broader sense of the word. One or two of them even felt vaguely unethical. And also they felt quite... as I say, they felt alienating, but they also felt like I had no connection with them. So I was basically it felt like an empty space, but there was a lot of pressure and there was an awful lot of pressure to do those tasks and keep my other work going at the same time. And I found myself really lost. And it was only afterwards that I looked back and I could see that burnout is a ladder, it's a pyramid. And I could see that I'd been climbing that pyramid. I mean, thank God I hadn't got to the top. Thank God I hadn't got to the suicidal ideation or anything like that. But I was suffering and I didn't realize it until afterwards.
Yes. And it's kind of, do you find it's kind of like you can't even turn it off, right? You just keep going and going and building. And it's, you try and have a break from it, but it's like your brain won't have a break from it. It's like, no, get back to it.
Yeah, with me, I mean, it was two things. First of all, I couldn't turn it off because I couldn't see it. I mean, if you're in a dark place, you can't see where you are. And so I didn't realize what was going on. But at the same time, a lot of the stress that I was feeling was manifesting itself in terms of guilt that I wasn't performing or guilt that I wasn't doing enough. And therefore, it felt at the time like the way to get out of it was to try harder. But of course, that was just playing into the jaws of the burnout. So yeah, it's really difficult to turn it off.
Oh man, I'm so with you there. Like I was in a similar zone end of last year and everything was going well
On the surface, it looked great. And, from the outside, everyone would go, oh, wow, you just, everything's really coming together. And overall, it was, but it was at the expense of mental health and being able to, we're probably terrible already at balance, balancing relationships, work, health. It's kind of a juggle already. But, the minute you're in burnout, it's kind of like you're so head down and hyper fixated going forward on something. You just, as you said, you can't see what you can't see, right?
And so you've hit on two particular things. I mean, let's just make it a bit dyslexia focused for a second. And the first thing is the executive function. We all know what executive function is, but for those who aren't yet familiar with the term, I always kind of describe it as most people that you meet have a secretary or a personal assistant living inside them. And for those of us with executive function challenges, that secretary or personal assistant is on holiday. And you've got nothing to prioritize, nothing to organize your life, nothing to help you switch from one task to another, nothing to help you initiate tasks, nothing to help you stop procrastination, nothing to help you focus on things. And it can get really, really stressful. And if you've got all sorts of different jobs and different tasks, it can become overwhelming really quickly. And the second aspect is how well people with dyslexia cope with that. So there's been a number of different studies that show that what they do is they wire you up, and they can wire people up and measure their reactions to stress. And then what they do is they feed you sort of emotional stimuli. It could be images or songs or whatever they are. And they measure how you react to that, how your pupils dilate, how your muscles tense, how you start sweating, that kind of thing. And there have been a couple of studies that have shown that people with dyslexia have a far more sensitive emotional reaction, a far greater emotional reaction to emotional input, that is to stress, essentially. And so, on the one hand, we have a huge emotional reaction, or a larger than typical emotional reaction to stress. We feel the stress because of the executive function challenges. And then, part of executive function is what they call emotional dysregulation. And that essentially means it's difficult to identify, name, articulate your emotions, and therefore regulate your emotions. So you've got this triangle. You've got the inability to organize things, or the challenges organizing things. You've got this hyper reaction to stress, and then you've got a lowered ability to deal with that stress. These things coming together are a perfect
Oh,
storm.
mate. That's very well said. And I love the PA in the brain just doesn't exist, right? Because it's so true, right? I hired a PA in my business. I've been so much more effective since I've had someone organizing me as a human, because I just don't naturally do it. And one of the things I'd add to what you mentioned there was the other thing to think about, the dyslexic mind naturally favors the visual thinking process, right? So it looks for pictures, movies, it's going really fast, and that makes it super quick. So we're already terrible at articulating stuff naturally. It's not our natural place. But when your brain is going so quickly and it's converting those visuals into emotions, just to keep it really simple, the challenge of that is that you can't articulate, you don't actually know why some emotions pop up, and you're not even potentially associating them to things like anxiety. Like, I don't think I understood what the word anxiety meant until I was touching 30. I'd heard the word, I'd been able to say it like I knew what it meant, but I couldn't identify with it in my body or how does it feel, right?
There has to be this what they call first personal experience. And so I remember, I mean, just a very silly example. I remember when I was 12 or 11 or something, and I was asked to write an essay on human reproduction in biology. And I wrote an essay on how the man's penis hardens, and he ejaculates semen into the woman, and I thought I knew what sex was. But of course I didn't know what sex was. I knew what the processes were. And it's the same with anxiety. You don't know what it is until you've had that first personal experience of it. In a similar way to, you could describe your best friend to me, and I would know what she or he looked like and how she or he reacts to ice cream and all sorts of stuff. But I wouldn't know her until I'd met her. And the same goes for anxiety.
Yeah, it's like, and we're such experiential learners, and without it, we're nothing. It's funny. I was reading, what came to mind when you said that is I was reading a coaching book recently, trying to improve my own skill set, And they gave this great example of how to get people to remember things. And this really works, I think, for the visual mind. But, you know, as a coach, I could say to you, behind you, there's a book that's red. And you know, in your head, you've got this idea of a book that's red. So that's part of it. But as a coach, what would be better for me to say is, there's a book behind you. Can you tell me and just can you describe it to me and describe the color in your own words? And you'd look at it and go, oh, it's a dark maroon and it has some white writing on it. And the input to your brain is so heightened because you've had the experience of explaining it and being part of it rather than just listening to me say it to you. Does that kind of make sense?
It makes total sense. And it reminds me of a process I'm involved in at the moment. So my website is not what I really want it to be. It was built in a hurry a few years ago and essentially became a bit of a data dump. So it's filled, you know, in one area, there's just loads of infographics for no apparent reason. In another area, there's information on this aspect of dyslexia, information on that aspect, information on that aspect. And there's no particular order, then there's some videos here and you don't know what order they're in, and it's just a bit of a messy data dump. And so I'm working with some students in Germany, because I work in Germany a lot, and I'm working with some students in Germany to essentially rebuild the website, to redesign the website. And today we had this conversation where it turned out that we had been talking at cross purposes. And I thought we were designing it in one way, and they thought we were designing it in another way. And I said, look, the reason this has happened is that I can't see what you're saying. Every time you tell me that you intend to do something, I need to see that. I need to see a picture of what you think the front page is going to look like. So I can say yes or no, or that's great, but could you change that? And then when I tell you, what I've been doing is I've been sending them pictures and they hadn't been giving me feedback on those pictures. So when I give you pictures, you need to tell me what you think of the pictures. And if you click on this, then you need to show me in an image what that's going to look like. Otherwise, I'm not understanding what you're saying. And it's really interesting because we are on a journey. I'm sort of taking them on a journey with me to learn about dyslexia. And I've been trying to impress upon them the visual thinking needs of people with dyslexia. But of course, it only becomes really apparent when that visual aspect is missing on the description of what the website's going to look like. And then we realize that we're not talking about the same thing. So a lot of the time it becomes apparent only at the point where it's almost too late. And so we as dyslexics need to be very, very aware of how we can articulate this to other people. Because, yeah, I've experienced exactly what you've been talking about just today. It was fascinating.
It really is. And you know, and when I'm not talking about dyslexia and my experience with it, you know, I'm a web designer by trade. And so our web design agency is built around dyslexia because I'm as, you know, dyslexic as anything. So, you know, it's a great point. We changed our process from being very much order form through to website, where what I actually do is I sit with a customer or a client, we share a screen on Zoom, for example, and we build the homepage together visually in front of each other. So within an hour, we've done what many companies struggle to do in 10 to 15 hours, because we've had this clear and open visual conversation, and it goes like that. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I was on a computer in an office today, and it's not the office I usually work on. And we were on Zoom, and there was no ability to speak or see me or anything on this computer. So I had to, instead of the computer, just use my phone, which is fair enough. But it did mean that I couldn't share anything because I had nothing stored on my phone. And it was so frustrating that I wanted to share things. I wanted to be able to see. Also, I wanted to be able to see the images they were sharing.
Yes.
And edit them and make little marks in them and say, what about this? What about this? A lot of the time, especially when we're working remotely, that's difficult.
This is where the work-life balance, the work balance, you know, the better you can communicate. Because I would say burnout, not on its own is communication driven, but it's definitely a big piece of it, is we are naturally, you know, someone said it to me well the other day, is the tireder we get, our communication goes out the window, because you know, and they put it in a simple terms, is that if our brains are favoring the visual, emotional kind of world, what we're having to do is when someone speaks to us, we're basically translating that into visual pictures in our head and then retranslating it out again. So if you imagine the processing power of that, it's intense, right? And so the later in the day you get, the shorter and sharper your communication gets, kind of like a child, right? And it just kind of, it goes out the window.
Yeah. And it's, as I say, the dyslexic brain generally works twice as hard anyway. So when you're translating, retranslating, and you're getting tireder and tireder, as we all do. And it's not necessarily based on the time of day, it's based on the intensity of the day. And this goes, takes us back to the initial conversation about executive function, about the ability to react to stress, the ability to control that reaction to stress. And so when we're living in a stressful situation, the ability to articulate what we mean becomes harder. That makes the situation more stressful. And this leads to anxiety, as you're talking about. This leads to mental health problems. It leads to feelings of guilt. It leads to feelings of panic. It leads to feelings of shame sometimes. And so, this communicative ability actually is not necessarily, it's not only the outcome. The difficulty in communication isn't only the outcome. It's often the cause of what makes things difficult. So this vicious circle appears.
Yeah, and so when we're struggling to communicate, we're also at the same time overthinking our communication. You know, I just always remember we had this amazing student of ours who came on one of the courses, and one of the examples he gave was, you know, he would sit there worrying about sending an email because he was overthinking what the person on the other end was going to do when he got the email. Had he written it well enough? Were they going to criticize him? Was he clear enough? Did he miss some information? And so this one email that, if he had knocked it out, could have gone out in 5 minutes, maybe half an hour, plus a bunch more stress on top of that, right?
Yeah. And I was talking, this week I'm working with a group of German professors. And we're working in English because on the one hand, my German's rubbish. I speak pub German, Kneiper Deutsch. But on the other hand, these German professors work in English and they need to improve certain aspects of their communication skills in English. And they still say to me, look, I do most of my work in English. I find it easier to do it in English. And yet I worry that I'm going to express it wrongly in English. And that stops me from expressing it at all. And it reminds me, when I was in my 20s, when I was younger, I did a lot of karate. And there are certain moves in karate. If anyone's done any martial arts at all, you'll know this. There are certain moves in karate that, when you think about them, should put you off balance. So, for instance, you're kicking to the side and you're holding your leg out, and that should put you off balance. But the more you think about it, the more likely to be off balance you are. The less you think about it, the more likely to be balanced and poised you are. And it's that being lost in the moment and allowing yourself to be lost in the moment.
Yes. And again, I think when you get to that point of stress and burnout, you lose that, right? And I think, you know, what I kind of see, and you put it well with time over COVID, you know, naturally we're very poor at zooming in and zooming out of our lives. And, you know, in a technique I use a lot when I'm getting stressed, and I don't use it enough. You know, we're all guilty of this. We all have these great tips that we, you know, we use sparingly, but being able to zoom out of the moment. And it was quite interesting. It was my wife's birthday yesterday, and we went out for lunch, and she sprung it on me that it was her birthday. No, that sounds terrible. She didn't spring it on her birthday. She reminded the PA that doesn't exist in my head that it was her birthday, and she liked to go out for lunch and dinner. So what that meant was I had to make sure it was in my calendar. That involved travel. It involved organization, making sure everything was going to go well. And you know, I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do it. I've got too much work on. And I had to take a moment to zoom out of my life and think, next year, when I think back to 2023, what am I going to remember more? The little bit of work I did, or that I went out for a beautiful lunch with my wife on her birthday? And it was quite obvious, the answer, when I took that moment to look at it from that angle. But if I was stuck in the moment, I'd just say, I'm too busy. Do you know what I mean? Does that kind of make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And there's something I've been looking at. There's been some work on what they call stress addiction. And what's really interesting is that as those people who have had long-term exposure to stress. And that generally includes most neurodivergent people, because, you know, you're at school and it's a stressful environment. You're in a social situation as a child, and that's a stressful environment. You know, you're trying to get a job, that's a stressful environment. So most neurodivergent people have had a long-term exposure to stress. And it becomes a little bit like, imagine when you go to the gym. I mean, I don't know if you go to the gym, but imagine you go to the gym or you exercise hard and you get this rush of let's call them endorphins. You get this rush of endorphins and you come to love them and you chase them and you get more and more until they become almost like the baseline of what normal is. And so you start chasing them, you need them. And you get these people who are essentially addicted to the endorphins of going to the gym. Well, let's look at it the other way around. Imagine that you've had a lifetime of stress, a long-term exposure to stress from childhood onwards. It's got to the point where the cortisol, essentially, and the endorphins that accompany that where these chemicals and these hormones, this what we would normally consider an imbalance, has become your baseline. It's become your norm. And in order to behave, in order to exist properly, you become almost addicted to getting this baseline of cortisols and dopamine and endorphins and stuff. And you are essentially, I mean, it's not a pathology, but you're essentially addicted to the stress. Now, for those of us who've lived a stressful life and who continue to live a stressful life, one of the questions is it necessary? And actually, in certain respects, it is. We need it.
Yeah.
And it becomes very difficult to escape that stress spiral. And so a lot of dyslexic people are not perhaps pathologically, but at very least sociologically addicted to stress.
Oh, so there, you know, it's kind of the way I look at it is it's kind of stimulants, right? You know, like I don't actually believe there, you know, many people are actually alcoholics or drug abusers. They're addicted to the feeling that comes off the back of it. And like someone stops one of them and be it a stress reaction to work, be it anything, it has to be replaced. And I remember early on when I gave up smoking years ago, I always thought, hey, Cole, you know, I'm not going to replace this with anything. That's just moving the addiction. But what I've kind of learned over the years is it's actually the only way to do it. You've got to move it. And again, you can move it into more healthy things, don't get me wrong, but it's, you know, if you try and go cold turkey, your brain will not react well to the level of boredom or the lack of those endorphins, dopamine, stimulants, whatever you want to call it, that are traipsing through your body, right?
Yeah. By the end of my 20s, I had an alcohol problem. I wasn't addicted to alcohol. So, you know, if I went a couple of days without it, I wouldn't be sweating and shaking and you know, sort of lying in bed feeling sick. I mean, I don't want to raise it to that level, but I was a serial and habitual binge drinker by the end of my 20s, and it became almost impossible not to be. And it took me about a year and a half to stop. And I tried all sorts of ways. And one thing that didn't work, one thing that never worked, is going cold turkey. I couldn't do it. The feelings weren't great. So I didn't know how to operate. I didn't know what to do. I was craving something, and it was a psychological craving. I don't think it was a physical craving.
Yeah.
But it was certainly a psychological craving. The idea of cold turkey just wasn't appropriate. A rather silly example, by the way. I mean, this is just a daft example, but another way of doing things. I remember a few years ago, I'd broken up with a girlfriend, or rather a girlfriend had broken up with me. And she and I still know each other. I still love her and respect her. She's a brilliant person. We're very close now. But at the time, it hurt. And I couldn't see life without her. And you know, the usual stuff. Well, this was the time that I thought it would be a good idea to quit sugar in tea and coffee. Now, what was really interesting is that what I did is as I quit sugar, I noticed that I could map the feelings of quitting sugar onto the feelings of having to quit this girlfriend, having to quit this relationship. But it started off as, I can't imagine tea and coffee without sugar. It's horrible. How can anybody do this? And it got then to the stage of, well, okay, I don't like tea and coffee without sugar, but I suppose I'll have to. And then, you know, you sort of map down to, oh, okay, right. I quite like tea and coffee without sugar. Now, I couldn't really imagine putting sugar into my tea and coffee. And it was that kind of gradual sort of a slipping back, but also the ability to map your feelings and map your journey.
That's a great.
It might sound like a silly example, but I was mapping the journey, and that was important for
I
me.
love that tangent because honestly, that's so true. Like I kind of call them aha moments, where or energy moments, or there's so many probably names for them. But when something comes into your life that's just sharp and it kind of cuts through everything you believe, your identity gets a knock, and at that moment, it's the best time to change. Like, because if you can map anything you want to get done at these, and sometimes they're good points, sometimes they're bad points, but it's these spikes in energy. I don't know about you, but they've always been the best times of my life to make like massive impact changes. Does it make sense?
100%, 100%. I had similar, not wanting to be too personal about this, I had similar in the early 2000s, when my stepdad died, and he died only a few months after my dad had died. And so this was a big existential sort of blow for me, losing my dad and my stepdad within about 5 months of each other. And I went into a bit of a depressive spiral. And in that time, the amount of stuff that subconsciously, I suppose, I moved myself to do this, but the amount of stuff I dealt with, the way that I related to other people, the way that I related to medicines I was taking at the time, that I didn't need the medicines, the way that I related to myself, I actually sorted so much stuff out, because it felt like, well, I think something felt like I've got nothing else to lose, and this is the perfect time to do it. So yeah, absolutely. These big epiphanal moments often come at times of disaster.
Yeah, and again, I because we're so good at handling them, and that's what I saw across the neurodiversity spectrum. The dyslexics, those with ADHD, could really handle, the chaos of COVID to a point. It was fantastic to have that much chaos, weirdly, outside of ourselves, rather than inside. Like, I don't know, it
It's a
just seemed
form of
to reflection, right?
Ritalin, isn't it? Ritalin is speed, basically, and most people would react quite badly to that. But people with ADHD, and I include myself among those, although I've never had a formal diagnosis, but people with ADHD actually find it a little bit calming. And
Oh
so
yeah,
that injection of
I take
Ritalin is
Ritalin.
actually,
I take Ritalin. It's amazing. I got it as an adult. It's game changing. The amount it balances your dopamine. It's just, it's really good if you can get your dose right. But it's important because I think, the thing with dyslexia is it usually comes along with friends. It doesn't like, and this is the challenge, I think, with the whole language around dyslexia to a point, is there are so many pieces to this puzzle. And I don't, it feels like, in a weird way, dyslexia or ADHD, they're very old diagnoses for something that if you looked at it with fresh eyes and reframed it, I think it would come out very differently. Does that kind of make sense?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, you said it comes along with friends, and I'm guessing some of these friends are ADHD, they're autism spectrum, they're all sorts of things like that. But it also comes in various shapes and sizes. So it comes with poverty, it comes with wealth, it comes with gender, it comes with social change, it comes with, and all of these, what you might call these intersections. So you've got the comorbidities on the one hand, and the intersections on the other hand. The comorbidities being ADHD, being OCD, being anxiety, and the intersections being, well, I'm dyslexic and I'm poor, or I'm dyslexic and I'm a black woman, or I'm dyslexic and I'm transgender, or non-binary. And these are at least as impactful on who you are as your dyslexia. And therefore, the dyslexia doesn't exist in a bubble. It's not that you can boil yourself down and go, here's the dyslexia, here's the gender, here's the ethnicity. You can't do that. They impact upon each other, and they inform each other, and they color each other. It's like you've got, when you're a child and you've got watercolors, and you've got the red and the green and the blue and the yellow and the purple, and when they mix, they form new colors.
Exactly.
And that's what your dyslexia is. It's a mixture of colors.
And I'm so with you there. And I think for anyone listening, or anyone, listening to this for a family member, everyone does play a slightly different game. There are a lot of commonalities. There are a lot of things where you might go, hey, these guys are talking to me. Now, for everyone who hears that, there might be something we say that you just don't connect with. And that's absolutely fine. But there may be something you connect with, like 10x what we're talking about. And this is the challenge, right? This is why there is such a poor diagnosis level is because so many people get completely bypassed because, you know, they don't fit the exact rules of the game. And yeah, it's missed, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, this is perhaps a tangent to what we've been talking about, but I mean, it's one of my favorite topics about the different ways that people diagnose. Now, what's really interesting is that in different, let's say in different regions, because they tend to come in regional clusters, these things, partially because of political reasons and financial and sociological reasons. But in different regions, different diagnosticians diagnose dyslexia differently. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is they don't see dyslexia as the same thing. So, for instance, in New Zealand, the New Zealand Dyslexia Association, slipped my mind for a second, but That's the true. Dyslexia Association in New Zealand defines it in one particular way. Over a couple of thousand miles away in Australia, the Australian Dyslexia Association defines it a different way. 5,000 miles north in Europe, the Italian Dyslexia Association defines it in a different way, and the British Dyslexia Association in a different way. So, first of all, people are looking for the definitions, and the definitions are different. And second, when they look within a definition, they're looking for certain things such as, I don't know, they're looking for something like phonological decoding or something along those lines. Well, different people actually understand different things by phonological decoding. And then what they do is they use different tools to look for them. And so you've got a difference in understanding of what something is, a difference in understanding of the constituent parts of it, and a difference in understanding of how you look for it. And this all adds up to different people are going to diagnose it completely differently. And therefore, you can actually lose your diagnosis if you move from one place to another. And it's happened a number of times.
That's intriguing, right? And it's so true. Like, I remember interviewing someone over in, I think it was South Dakota. And she said, like, they didn't even recognize dyslexia in the state until, I think, 2019. There was the last state in America to actually have something written down about dyslexia, which is mad. Like, 2019 feels ridiculous. But, you know, it just shows you how diverse, you know, these are and how poorly understood many of the challenges are across.
And there's a guy in England called Professor Rod. Oh, and I've forgotten his second name. It could be Rod Nichols. I'm not 100% certain.
It'll come to you in the middle of the night. You'll just wake up and
it will. Professor Rod, someone or other, anyway. And he's actually making a very influential, if I would say mistaken, but a very influential case that dyslexia doesn't exist. Mm. And because of this, that kind of narrative is starting to get traction in Britain. And you'll get fewer and fewer people talking about dyslexia. So they might talk about reading difficulties, or they might just talk in slightly more abstract terms of specific learning difficulties or something. And the less that people talk about dyslexia, the less they focus on it. And what it means is that, while in America, they've only, you know, certain states have only just recognized it. In Britain, we're in a fight to keep it recognized. Mm-hmm. It was recognized in about 1987, and now it looks like there's a chance it may be hidden again, simply because different dyslexics manifest in different ways. And so surely there's no such thing as dyslexia. Well, that's a completely mistaken view, but it's becoming quite influential.
It's intriguing the way the world works around, just as it feels like, you know, neurodiversity is starting to get a foothold in general, which is good. But again, it's like each of these challenges is fighting, we're all fighting different battles, right?
Yeah. I released a video a while back. And I don't know whether the title makes any sense, but it was, "What Do Dyslexics Sound Like?" And the idea is, imagine that you're not part of the dyslexic community, whatever the dyslexic community is. And imagine you come across dyslexic people talking for the first time. What do we sound like? Do we sound angry with each other? Do we sound like we're sort of drawing battle lines between each other? Because a lot of the time we do. And this is quite unfortunate. And if that happens, if it sounds like we're being prescriptive to each other, we're shouting at each other, For instance, saying, oh, you can't say you're a dyslexic. You've got to say you are dyslexic rather than you are a dyslexic, or you have dyslexia. You can't say that. You know, this kind of conversation. People who aren't dyslexic will listen to this and think, whoa, and they'll kind of back off because we appear a little bit angry. And it's really important that we ground everything we do in inclusivity and in love. Because whilst we're throwing stones at each other, which sometimes happens, that doesn't sound inclusive. So we have to practice what we preach. We have to put our money where our mouth is in that respect.
Oh, exactly. And I think, you know, this is, you know, coming back to the kind of thought process around work and life and burnout, because I think, you know, you're quite right. Like, everyone does have different challenges, and we're all going to have different challenges in the workplace and outside of it. But I think as well, that recognition, that acceptance and awareness, like, you know, it's such an unsexy thing to say, right? But it's the awareness of how your mind works, the acceptance of it, is, in my opinion, 80 to 90% of the battle. Because once you get over that kind of barrier and you go, hey, okay, my mind works differently, I favor the visual side, I can see things, I'm more spatial, I can do all this stuff, but actually trying to bring that into reality causes a lot of pain, and it's not working very well, and it's causing problems. The more we can accept and understand that, the more we can give ourselves that space, you know, the more you can find the solutions to get you further. But I think without that initial step in the work-life balance, you know, we are more favorable to burnout. Like, I, you know, I was touching it last year, but because of my self-awareness, I was able to bring myself back from it without getting really bad and going, hey, what happens if I just stop doing everything for a week? Would the world end? No, it wouldn't. And do you know what? Does it kind of make sense, ring true with you?
It makes perfect sense. And it reminds me that when you're a child and there's a monster under the bed, when you actually identify what that is, and it's actually just an old cardboard box, you know, suddenly it's not frightening anymore. And you know, I suppose the opposite end of that is when they finally discover that the Loch Ness Monster is an eel or something, then it'll cease to be the Loch Ness Monster. It'll cease to be romantic. But what this shows is that once we can observe and identify, and once we can look dispassionately at something and accept it for what it is, it stops being frightening. It stops being overwhelming. It stops being something we can't deal with. And so, yeah, the first step is to observe ourselves and to ask, well, what's going on here? And for me, when I was given my dyslexia diagnosis the first time around, because I've had two now, when I first found out I was dyslexic, I went through 6 months of shame. I felt absolutely ashamed, and I couldn't quite put my finger on why. Was it that I was ashamed I'd been given the diagnosis? Was I ashamed of being dyslexic? Was I ashamed at how other people would see me? What was it? And I wasn't certain, but somebody gave me a book or prompted me to buy a book, which is Ron Davis's The Gift of Dyslexia.
Yeah.
And when I read that, it opened so many windows into my own mind for me that I thought, of course, that's who I am. And I accepted myself almost overnight without even having to try. It just became natural.
It's a great book. You know, have you ever done any of the Davis Dyslexia courses?
I haven't, no.
The life, when I, you know, shout out to remarkableminds.org on this, because I did it with them. They, you know, there's a course called Life Concepts, which is amazing. It's not about the reading and writing side, but they use play to help you understand really core phrases or identify what they call trigger words. So words like concepts we struggle with, time is one of them. Cause and effect is one that always rings true with me. But understanding how that works, because naturally the dyslexic mind struggles with non-physical words and phrases. So cause and effect is something you'll notice if you've got kids, they really struggle with. They're kind of like cats, unless you spray them, kids with dyslexia at the time, with water, and they realize there's a connection. They you know, you could punish them and it doesn't matter because they haven't connected it with the previous point. And so, you know, it's called Life Concepts, Davis Dyslexia. But honestly, I did that. It was the most intense course I think I've ever done in my life. But the amount of ahas, the amount of awareness, the amount of identity change was, honestly, I can't even explain it, if I'm honest. It's that good.
No, I understand it. I was recently speaking to a Davis practitioner. who thankfully did something that I'm glad she did, because a lot of Davis practitioners have this language about the Davis correctional method, as though we're being somehow corrected. And that always feels a bit uncomfortable. But this lady, she'd removed that phrase from her website. And she does amazing work in Ireland. It's called the Paragraph Challenge. And she does really good work in Ireland. And she's a Davis facilitator. And she's a wonderful woman. And it's all about focusing on what you can do. And yeah, it's not about, as you say, focusing on your phonological processing deficits. That's not what they do. And it's a great way of approaching dyslexia.
And I think this is the thing for anyone out there who's looking for solutions, like, for the kind of, probably a good place to, to end this actually is around the work kind of, solutions. And kind of the way I see it is you've got micro coping strategies. And we've been doing a lot of these on the podcast, looking at daily activities, be it exercise, walking, different apps and tools you can use. There's so many now. It's just we could do about 25 podcasts just on the different apps that exist. But there's that kind of level of what I would call tactical solutions. Those are the things that will make little differences in little places, and once they're done consistently, will add massive value to your life. And then you've got the second stage of this identity change. And it's exactly as you've mentioned, Martin. If you when you find out you're dyslexic, you're changing your identity, right? This is an identity shift. And at that moment, things are going to change at a big level. And it's the same with when I did the Davis Dyslexia course and other things like that. There are a bunch of different cool things out there. But I think, if you're at work and you're trying to work out what to do, is you can do a bit of both. Bring in some of those tactical changes, but don't get so stuck in looking for those quick fixes that you ignore the main big life changes, because they're the ones that will move the whole body. Is that kind of on par? What are your thoughts, Martin, on that?
Yeah, very much, very much. I mean, you talk about exercise, incredibly important to exercise, incredibly important. And there are people who can't, and that's really difficult for them, but there'll be some things that they can do, getting out into the sunshine if that's possible, that sort of thing. But exercise is really important, and not only does it have a physiological effect and a mental effect on you, it actually helps learning. And it doesn't only help learning by making you more in the mood for learning, it helps make connections in the brain. But the act of going and exercising provides some structure for you in your life. And these tiny little things that you talked about, I was discussing a couple of days ago with somebody, the idea of having a little diary, and you just write down in the diary at the end of the day one little triumph, one thing that you've done that was good. You don't have to do anything else, just one thing that you've done that was good. And then what you've done is you've got this log of triumph. And most of the time, we don't focus on the triumph. Back to the burnout, we focus on the guilt of getting things wrong. We focus on the tragedy. We focus on the disaster fantasy, on building up these monsters that aren't really there, rather than looking at the positives in life and valuing the positive things in life. And yeah, 100%, everything that you've said. And it feeds back to this idea that what we can do is we can actually combat burnout by just making little notes of the positive things that we do in our lives and start focusing them on them, just looking at them and going, oh yeah, I did that today. Doesn't have to be much, just a little thing. Oh yeah, I got to work on time. I haven't done that for a week. I got to work on time. That's great. Something like that.
Yeah, mate, I'm so with you. And probably my last thing for me on burnout is, what really has gotten over the last 3 or 4 years, how I've kind of solved or brought myself out of it, is making sure that I have a direction of where I'm going and I'm clear on what that direction is. People have so many names for this mission goal. There's a billion names. I like to call it the direction. So it's like having a map. And I can't always see the next road I'm going to take, but I know where I'm going and why I'm going there. That's really clear. There's a purpose. And the great thing is along the journey, I can check in and go, am I getting there? Do I actually need to go this fast to the journey if that's burning me out? Or do I need to take a different road? Or do I need to just take a break from the road? But having that direction, it always keeps me going in the right way. Whereas the old me would have had very finite goals to achieve. If I didn't achieve them, I was a failure. Where now I have directions, I don't even have timelines anymore on them. Like I know some of them come quicker, some of them take longer, but the direction you know, keeps me solid, and it removes a lot of burnout. I'm not sure about yourself on that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, let's go back to the idea of the gym. I can't exercise in the way that I used to exercise because I exercised too much and my knee went, and I'm unable to run. I'm unable to play tennis. I'm unable to do all that kind of stuff. I can hike, I can cycle, but these things are things that you've got to make time to do once a month or once every couple of weeks or something. So I spend a lot of time going to the gym because it's easier. It provides some structure to my life, and it's a quick fix in terms of exercise. Well, I was thinking quite recently that over lockdown, I don't know whether this makes much sense to you. I'm going to use English money, as it were. English
Yeah,
English.
Go for it, mate. Go for it.
Over lockdown, I put on nearly 2 stone. That's essentially, I went from about 74 or 76 kilos to about 94 kilos. So about 76 to 94 kilos. That's quite a lot. And of course, a lot of it, because I've been doing a lot of exercise. I mean, I wasn't a big muscular man, but I lost a lot of muscle mass and replaced it with body fat. And then, so going from 76 to 94 wasn't simply putting on whatever it was, 18, is it 18 kilos or something?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Give or take. Cool.
Yeah, about 18 kilos. It wasn't just putting on 18 kilos. It was putting on more than 18 kilos of fat because I was losing a certain amount of muscle mass as well. Well, I became a little bit self-conscious and unhappy with myself because of that. And so, and in fact, I'm guessing that if we look back on our last podcast together and our last chat together, my face will look bigger.
You definitely look thinner. I'll give it to you, mate. You definitely
a little bit. It's just kind lighting, I think.
Great lighting. Yeah, great lighting. Lighting has lost every kg for you, mate. You've done well.
But yeah, it was a few weeks ago that I weighed myself, and I was so I've got a little bit of tone back, and I'm back down to about 86 kilograms. So about halfway there, not quite, but about halfway there. And I thought, God, it's taken about a year, but actually, I'm really enjoying the journey. And that's part of it as well. Having that goal, having that direction, having that aim is a great thing. Having the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is fantastic. But we've got to enjoy the rainbow. We've got to really enjoy the journey to get there as well, because that's such an important thing. Without that, it can feel hopeless and empty and difficult. And with it, it can feel joyous.
And that's where burnout, when you don't know where you're going and you're just going there really fast, you're on a way to burnout, right? But if you know where you're going, you know, you can always tweak the method. And I think that's a key place. So thank you so much, Martin. You're a legend. What is there any, where can people find your awesome work that you do for dyslexics?
Well, okay. So I suppose there's a couple of places. The first thing, if you want to listen to me ranting about dyslexia related topics, go to YouTube, www.youtube.com, and then /, and there's one word, Dyslexia Bites. That's dyslexia, BYTES. So youtube.com/dyslexiabites. You can find me on dyslexiabites.org. And there's another website you can find then as well, which is where I've been discovering different measurements of dyslexia internationally. And that's called the Dyslexia Compass. And that's dyslexiacompass.eu. It's a European Union project. So dyslexiacompass.eu, and that's fascinating. It shows how dyslexia is measured differently around the world.
Interesting. I'll try and link to those in the podcast notes, guys. Okay. Jump into the show notes. Thank you so much for being a guest, Martin. Is there any last words you want for the amazing audience?
Yeah, there is. There's one really important last word. You do phenomenal stuff. You do absolutely amazing stuff, Stephen. I'm absolutely thrilled to be talking to you, and I can't tell you enough that what you're doing is actually making a difference. So thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Martin. Appreciate it, mate. Well, thank you for being on. We'll definitely have you again. And until next time, guys, that was Stephen from The Truth About Dyslexia.